From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Saeed Erekat, Washington correspondent and political analyst for the Jerusalem-based Al-Quds Daily Newspaper. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The United States and Iran take a step back from war, this after Iran attacked bases housing American troops, which itself was retaliation for the killing of a top Iranian general. A Ukrainian passenger jet crashes minutes after taking off from Tehran. Western intelligence agencies believe it was shot down by Iran. And more on Iran, President Trump wants NATO, the North Atlantic Military Alliance, to get more involved in the Middle East. And here in the United States, the impeachment trial of President Trump looms. Well, Tom and Saeed, I'm really glad that both of you are here. There's just an awful lot to talk about. And I want to start with you, Tom. Has war between the United States and Iran been averted or just delayed?
Well, at the very least delayed, possibly averted. I think the two countries who have no use for one another have been at the brink in recent days, especially after the drone strike killed probably the most prominent military official in Iran, and Iran launched some retaliatory strikes. Two bases in Iraq where Americans are stationed, no casualties. I think there's been some muscle flexing on the part of the Iranians, but I think for vastly different reasons. Neither country wants to engage in a war. The president, ironically, has been trying to get out of the Middle East. He says he does not support endless wars in that part of the world, and if he had his way, he would just pull out, but he can't pull out because of a variety of reasons. The Iranians are strapped because of the economic sanctions issued against them by the West. And I think there was muscle flexing, there was a little chest beating, and I think at the moment I would describe the situation as a very tense stalemate.
Saeed, put yourself in the shoes of the Iranians, if you could. What do they want?
Well, the Iranians, more than anything, they want the sanctions lifted. They want the world to abide by what they see as an obligation that was signed into at the, you know, in 2015. And they feel that they have done everything under that agreement, and accordingly, they ought to be rewarded in terms of getting their money back. You know, I mean, people talk about how Obama gave them a lot of money. That is not Obama's money or the administration's money. That is really their money. They want to be able to export their oil. They want to be able to live in the region, but they also want to exert their influence as a regional power. That's what Iran wants, and that is what it has been denied under this present administration.
A couple of things that both of you have alluded to, these domestic problems that they right. have. Their economy is in deep trouble. There have been these huge protests against the regime, and you get right. the impression that the mullahs are kind of hanging on by brute force right. in some cases. Why don't they focus on their internal problems rather than kind of the, you just said, that want to export their influence or stirring up trouble abroad? They've got a bunch of troubles at home.
Let's remember, I mean, it was, and I remember this very well because I was in Iraq as the United Nations spokesman for 5 years, and I witnessed this firsthand. It was really, in many ways, the United States that empowered Iran back into Iraq and to exert that influence. And we can cite this military base, for instance, from the name of it. This was named Al-Qadisiyah, which is, you know, a battle that goes back in history between Arabs and Persians and so on. So immediately after the occupation, they changed the name, you know, with the blessing of the Americans and so on. I'm saying that, you know, Iran was allowed to exert its influence in Iraq by the invasion and occupation of Iraq by the United States of America. But you're right. I mean, you know, they do feel that by having influence, by having proxies in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, everywhere, they can exert that pressure. And they feel that they have a right to do so because Turkey is doing the same thing. Israel is doing the same thing.
You know, Tom, President Trump campaigned 4 years ago on the notion that the so-called P5+1 deal with Iran, the United States, France, Britain, Germany, Russia, and China, this nuclear deal with Iran, he said it was a horrible deal, and it wasn't too long before he got out. After he got into office, he pulled out of that deal. The question is, have events of the past week helped Iran in terms of getting the bomb? It was adhering to the agreement. Mm-hmm. Everybody seemed to agree prior to this recent conflict. I mean, what about now?
Well, now the Iranians have said, even though the United States has pulled out of the deal, Iran would honor the deal. But now, in the aftermath of this military strike, they've said we reserve the right to ignore the terms of the 2015 deal, which, if they follow through on that, means they can continue and expand the enrichment of uranium. And so maybe it's largely symbolic, but I don't see there's any impetus to get back the deal. If the United States is not going to be a signatory any longer, I don't think the prospects of the deal reemerging are very good.
And this issue of President Trump saying, well, he said that I am willing to work with anybody who embraces peace. That's a nice thing to say, and he fancies himself as this master negotiator. But if you look at, say, North Korea, he's met with Kim, I think, 3 times now, and that really has not come to much. What are the expectations that he could really accomplish anything with Iran? Who wants to take that?
Yeah, I'll take that. Well, I mean, this president came into office promising that he wants to have a better deal because this was the worst deal possible. The truth of the matter, this was a very thorough deal. It ensured that Iran would never acquire a nuclear bomb. You know, the whole world agreed to it. The past administration agreed to it in details. They had a very intrusive inspection system and so on. There isn't much room for Iran to give. I mean, you know, the only probably flexible issue here is what the so-called sunset clause, you know, and instead of 15 years, maybe make it 25 years, but not much else. You know, perhaps this administration and Israel want to include, let's say, the ballistic missile as part of this deal, but that's a different thing altogether. So I don't really see, I agree with Tom, I don't see a new deal sort of emerging that it can satisfy the United States and satisfy Israel, and then, on the other hand, also be satisfactory to Iran, unless we go back, you know, to basically the same deal, except with Trump's stamp.
So where does that leave? Where do we go from here?
I think we are probably, you began by asking whether war has been averted. I think war is probably been delayed. The war is ongoing. You know, there is a huge economic burden and placed on Iran because of the U.S. sanctions, the banking system. They cannot do any business. They're strapped. They feel this issue is unsustainable. And we will probably see more efforts to sort of stir the pot by the Iranians, much like we saw by the attack of the cargo ships or the attack on Aramco.
Well, how does that help in terms of them getting sanctions?
Well, lifted? I mean, you know, see, pushing the world into the edge may make them think otherwise, or the world makes them think otherwise. You know, we'll see what the commitment of the Europeans and how is it going to endure. You know, like Tom said, without the United States, this deal really does not have much of being alive in any way, shape, or form, where Iran can sort of scroll back into a nation that can have sustained economic abilities and so on and actually be able to live with some sort of harmony in the region.
In the meantime, as all this was playing out, a Ukrainian passenger jet crashed just a couple of minutes after taking off from Tehran's principal airport. At first, everybody thought it was just a tragic crash, another Boeing 737 crash. Now it's believed U.S. and British intelligence agencies now believe that it was actually shot down by an Iranian a missile. What are you hearing about this, Tom?
I'm hearing the same thing, Paul, that it's not clear whether it was a tragic accident or malice aforethought. I tend to think it was a tragic accident, basically the result of a clumsy command and control by the Iranians. But it's just U.S. intelligence and Western intelligence is now saying with what the experts call a high degree of certainty, meaning we have clear and convincing evidence that an Iranian missile brought down this airplane. And we may never know whether it was on purpose. I doubt it was on purpose, but it was certainly give one pause when you worry about command and control in the Iranian Islamic military. I think it was not intentional because it's nothing good can come of this for the Iranians, but I think they bear the responsibility for
it. It's almost sort of like they feared perhaps that American jets were attacking or something.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
It could be because, you know, depending on the timeline, we don't know what the timeline is. It simultaneously as the missiles were going out to hit the Al-Assad air base and Erbil, or is it, you know, like a couple of hours later and so on? Of course, it's very tragic and it's very sad. It could, more than likely, it seems to be some sort of a tragic accident. They're saying that the Iranians used an A-15, I guess an A-15 missile, and it's an old missile and so on. Maybe the crews are not well trained. But today we've seen the Iranians allow inspectors in, you know, from Canada, from Ukraine, and even from the United States. So we'll see. Although they say that the crash scene has been all cleaned up. But I don't see how Iran would do something like this intentionally. But it could conceivably, I mean, the experts are saying that could have been brought down by missile.
And one issue, of course, is the black box recorder the plane, which perhaps could yield some interesting clues about this. They so far, I think, have refused to turn that over to Western authorities.
Yeah, at one point I heard that they claimed that the black boxes were destroyed. So we don't know, I mean, that whether they were destroyed and so on. There were conflicting reports. They will probably share whatever, you know, remains of these black boxes, if it's still audible and so on, with the inspectors.
Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Saeed Erekat, Washington correspondent and political analyst for the Jerusalem-based Al-Quds Daily Newspaper, and our moderator, Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. I want to return to the big story that we've been talking about, which, of course, is Iran. This week, the U.S. House of Representatives, that, of course, is the lower chamber of the American Congress, or Parliament, if you will, approved a resolution restricting President Trump's authority to attack Iran without congressional approval. Now, in the House, a handful of Republicans actually crossed over and voted against the president on this. It now goes to the Senate. What is the Senate expected to do, Tom?
Well, I suspect there's a reasonable chance that a majority of the Senate will go along, but it's really academic. First of all, it's non-binding, the resolution. President is not bound in any way, even if it were to pass. If it were to pass the Senate, President almost certainly would veto it, and he almost certainly would have the votes to override the veto. But again, it's a non-binding resolution. It's important because it tells you that there is a majority in both houses of Congress unhappy with the president's lack of transparency and lack of consultation in wars. This is a fight that's been going on for ever since Vietnam, and ever since the War Powers Act was passed decades ago, saying the Constitution gives Congress authority to declare wars, but in recent decades, most presidents have decided that the better part of valor is to launch military action in defense of the country and notify Congress later. And there's been this institutional back and forth, and I think this is the latest iteration. It's a way for Congress to say to the president, you're overstepping your constitutional authority, Mr. President. But President Trump, just like predecessors, will ignore that. It's just a way to signal growing displeasure, not just about the president's belief that he can do anything he wants, more or less, under Article 2 of the Constitution, but also just to suggest that they're unhappy with the lack of transparency. There seems to be a real irritation on Capitol Hill about the briefings involving the attack that took out General Hassami. Even Republican senators who are very loyal to the president have described these briefings after the fact as sophomoric, insane, insulting. The administration said this action was taken because there were imminent terror attacks about to be launched by Iran. But the evidence they have presented to congressional leaders, according to those who've gotten the briefings, is not specific, to put it mildly.
So the Saeed is really, as Tom was saying, it's really about the big picture, kind of a fight between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And it does go back to Vietnam. The War Powers Act that Tom was referring to was actually signed in 1973 under the Nixon era. And Nixon actually vetoed that in Congress. Yes. And the battle has been going on ever since. But Tom said, and I agree, that the president would simply ignore this. It's a non-binding thing. Does that mean that the president will just ignore them and do what he wants with Iran?
I think so. I think that's what we have seen since September 11th, 2001, after the attacks. So we've seen that time and again. They always cite their predecessors. They can cite that this is what Obama did with Osama bin Laden. This is what we did with al-Baghdadi and so on. So there is precedent. The problem is there is a great deal of elasticity in terms of defining that imminent danger. I mean, we've listened to the Secretary of State on Fox News, I think, saying basically that imminent is not that imminent. You know, it wasn't that imminent. No targets were specified. We listened to National Security Advisor O'Brien, you know, yesterday was saying, he was saying that, you know, we knew they were planning something, but they would not share. The people in Congress, the Senate, you know, and Mike Lee, for instance, you know, of Utah, came out and said there was nothing convincing there. There's nothing there. Rand Paul suggested the same thing. So I think the problem is if Qasem Soleimani was termed to be defined or designated to be the second most important person in Iran after Khamenei, what if the administration or Trump decides to, let's say, take out the spiritual leader Khamenei? You know, if he took out the second person, you know, then they could conceivably take the first person. So what if they decide to do that and then all hell would break loose? I think it's probably, although it is symbolic, I have no doubt that it would definitely shake the executive branch. It would, you know, maybe be a tempering. It would have a tempering effect on, let's say, decisions like this in the future.
There's another angle to all of this, too. President Trump also had a chat with the Secretary General of NATO, that, of course, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, founded back in 1949. He wants the alliance to get more involved in the Middle East, kind of vague about what that means. You know, Tom, the president has spent 3 years making very dismissive comments about NATO, other European allies. He at one point even suggested that the United States could get out of NATO. Now he's coming to them and saying, help.
Well, the ironies abound here. That's exactly right. He spent all this time dumping all over NATO, saying with some justification that they haven't agreed to meet their targets for NATO spending. But he's gone about systematically insulting many leaders there. He's not happy with the French. He's not happy with the Germans. He's happy with his ideological soulmate Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. And he and the NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg, they seem to get along very, very well. But the notion that after all of this alliance bashing for 3 years is going to cause the NATO allies to roll over and expand their presence in an extremely volatile part of the world is a non-starter. I mean, the president, like all presidents, I think he wants to have it both ways. That won't happen.
Is there any goodwill between President Trump and the Europeans? I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of gas in that tank.
Obviously not. He consulted with the Israelis. He consulted with Saudi Arabia. He consulted with the Emirates, allegedly, before assassinating Qasem Soleimani, but he never told the Europeans anything. So I'm not so sure about how much of a goodwill there is between this president and the Europeans. But also expanding NATO, it was only months ago when the United States sort of was shepherding some sort of an alliance akin to NATO in the Middle East that would include Saudi Arabia, the Gulf countries, Israel, Egypt, and so on. What happened to that? I mean, there is so much role that NATO can play. Let's not forget, NATO has been active in Afghanistan, even in Iraq. I mean, we're seeing them pulling away, actually, in the last few days, or saying they want to reposition and so on. So I'm not so sure how you would include Middle Eastern countries into the NATO alliance, but I can see where actually the United States could probably put into effect the plans for some sort of another alliance in the region.
Well, his idea was to actually change the name of NATO. He wanted to call it NATO-ME, in other words, add the Middle East acronym to the end of that, so that apparently is what he is thinking. We've got a couple of minutes left, and I did want to turn our attention to, lest we forget, this president has also been in impeached and is still facing a Senate trial, which, of course, has not happened yet. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, is under pressure to send over these two articles of impeachment to the Senate, abuse of power, obstruction of Congress. When is that going to happen, Tom? And what are you hearing about when this Senate trial will actually occur?
Well, I suspect it'll be at the end of January. I think there's probably some pressure to try to get it over with before the State of the Union address, where the president comes to Congress every year, every president, and addresses the Congress about the State of the Union. That's February the 4th. And Speaker Pelosi, he has recently said the articles of impeachment will be sent over in a very few days. Nobody knows what that means. She's trying to maneuver with the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Mitch McConnell, over procedures. And McConnell has talked to the White House about the procedures of a trial, but he hasn't talked to the Democrats, and she's trying to see if she can get any leverage here. I don't think she has much, frankly, because McConnell controls the Senate. President Trump will be acquitted in the Senate and will remain in office. But there's an argument over witnesses. The Democrats want some witnesses to be called. McConnell and the White House don't want any witnesses to be called. So I suspect the answer is sooner rather than later, but not immediately.
The State of the Union, which you alluded to, I think, is February the 4th. That is less than a month away now. And Saeed, Tom was talking about these possible witnesses. One of them, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, has said that he's willing to testify if he's subpoenaed. But McConnell doesn't seem like he wants any witnesses. What's going to happen with that?
Well, if McConnell doesn't want any witnesses, Bolton will not be subpoenaed. This is the thing. It depends on how much pressure the Democrats can put on McConnell, how they can bring him around. I mean, if they went to side the Clinton and the precedent, you know, there were three witnesses, I think, that were brought in, and they said that we wanted to bring in three witnesses beforehand. So Pelosi does have some level of influence. I believe she will probably turn in the articles of impeachment by the week of the 20th of January because of the time element, because of the State of the Union address and so on. They need to do it then. But Bolton, if he could be subpoenaed, I think he could probably be very credible witness for the prosecution in this case.
Is the House's work done here? What's stopping the House from subpoenaing Bolton, getting him to testify there, and at least getting his story out in public?
There's nothing that would stop that. I mean, the House of Representatives, as does the Senate, has broad investigatory powers. So there's nothing to stop one or more committees in the House from subpoenaing John Bolton and compelling him to testify. So that's a live scenario, I believe.
Now, the other issue is, of course, that the longer this goes on, you sort of get the sense that the power, the drama of these two articles of impeachment, sort of the air is kind of hissing out of the balloon. The longer this goes on, the less impact it's going to have, which obviously would benefit the president, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the Democrats are caught between a rock and a hard place because on the one hand, they feel they could hang on to it, you know, not indefinitely, but they can hang on to these two articles for a period of time, you know, letting the president stew in his own juices and so on. But as you said, on the other, they would lose much of their luster if it drags on and so on. So they need to do it, but they need to use whatever leverage they have so they can have some witnesses.
And there's no sense, Tom, at least according to the poll, that this has really made much of a dent in the president's approval. His approval, at least in the Republican Party, appears to remain rock solid, though it has to be pointed out that the Republican Party is still shrinking a little bit. But his approval rating overall still seems to be, low to mid-40s, right? It hasn't really budged.
Right. I think if, given the strength of the American economy, his numbers might be in the 60s were it not for a variety of other factors. But his support has remained below 50%, but it's held steady, and it's remained steady throughout the whole impeachment business. I think the impeachment process has now been discounted. The country believes that President Trump will be acquitted in the Senate and not removed from office, and then the haggling and the hassling and the fighting will live for another day. So I think impeachment's impact is now told.
There's a phrase that was applied to prior presidents that could almost be applied to President Trump, and that is he is a Teflon president. Almost nothing seems to stick to him, right?
He has been remarkably lucky in that respect. And as I've said many times before, overnight is a lifetime in politics. We now have about 10 months left until the next election, and who knows what will happen. But at the moment, the president has more than a little Teflon attached to him. I agree with you, Paul.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal, and Saeed Erekat of Al-Quds Daily. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis. Thank you very much for joining us.